The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Welcome to the 2017 Internal Medicine Board Review Course, sponsored by the American College of Osteopathic Internists. The course was held March 22nd through 26th, 2017, at the JW Marriott Las Vegas Resort and Spa. The course featured nationally known speakers presenting a wide variety of topics of interest to the internist preparing for certification or recertification in the specialty of internal medicine. Pituitary and related disorders is presented by Dr. Jack Snitzer.
Pituitary is anterior and posterior aspects, and the posterior and anterior basically are different animals. Thyroid-stimulating hormone, prolactin is in the, this is anterior, growth hormone, corticotropin, which is ACTH, and luteinizing hormone or follicle-stimulating hormones. Posterior are hormones that are made in the hypothalamus. This is needs to be remembered, but they're stored in the pituitary, such as vasopressin, in other words, ADH, antidiuretic hormone, and oxytocin. Tumors in the pituitary are common. They're usually benign adenomas. Common, about 70 to 80% are functional. About 20 to 30% are non-functional, therefore. Microadenoma is defined as less than 1 centimeter. Macroadenoma, 1+ centimeter. And they can classically cause bitemporal hemianopsia. You know, if it's big enough, an ophthalmologist should be involved doing visual field tests regularly on these patients. Hypopituitarism or partial hypopituitarism, headaches, amenorrhea, galactorrhea, in youth, growth or pubertal delay, infertility, decreased libido, erectile dysfunction. One thing I see that is a little bit concerning is that patients with severe hypogonadism who have a workup out there in their general practice office, they shouldn't be treated if they have severely low testosterone until you've ruled out pituitary insufficiency due to, say, a tumor. Because you don't just want to treat them and forget that there might be a cause for this. And you don't want to forget that, we'll talk about this later, that they could have secondary hypogonadism from the pituitary or could be primary from the testicles. You got to figure this out really before you treat them, because once you treat them, the blood tests aren't useful. You have to stop the medications to test them again. If a pituitary tumor is suspected or being followed, order an MRI of the head, attention cella turcica, with and without contrast. Has to be with and without contrast. CAT scan won't show it, might miss even relatively large pituitary tumors. And MRIs that are done just generally without special attention to the pituitary, they might miss a small pituitary adenoma. All across the board, pituitary, just like adrenal tumors, all pituitary tumors require testing for hormonal hypersecretion and, in this case, for pituitary insufficiency. Visual fields must be checked if the tumor is large and follow-up MRI obtained. Surgery usually recommended if visual field defects, impingement of the tumor on the optic chiasm. If the report from your radiologist doesn't mention anything about the optic chiasm and the relationship to the pituitary tumor, send it back and get it amended. Or if you have significant growth, surgery would be recommended. Can be incidental. Non-secretory tumors can be incidental and often are microadenomas. Can be large and might cause partial or full hypopit. Person has a car accident. They come in, MRIs of their or a CAT scan or MRI is taken of their head. You see something big in there, get an MRI. It's a huge pituitary tumor. Not an uncommon situation. I've had patients like this. And then, by the way, they were saying that that they've been feeling like they had the flu for about a year, year and a half. You start thinking maybe they do have some issues with partial hypopituitarism. So visual field defects could be occurring if they have a large pituitary tumor, could have pituitary insufficiency, might not. And remember, you often don't manifest signs of adrenal insufficiency until you're under stress. So you could be going on perfectly fine with a pituitary tumor, then all of a sudden you get the flu, or all of a sudden you get in a car accident, and instead of being a little bit sick, you're terribly sick. And I find that all the time also. Prolactinoma is the most common functioning pituitary tumor. It's galactorrhea, infertility oftentimes, amenorrhea, decreased libido can cause hypogonadism in females or males. So high prolactin, if somebody has low testosterone, Next tests include a prolactin, again, before you treat it, because if they have a high prolactin causing a low testosterone, you treat the prolactin, not the testosterone usually. Note, prolactin elevation is generally proportional to the size of the tumor. A lot of tumors are very efficiently secreting prolactinomas. In other words, the size is proportional to the secretion. The bigger it is, the more prolactin. But every now and then you have an inefficiently functioning prolactinoma where the size, the level's not as high as you'd expect. And these tumors may or may not shrink all the way when you treat them. Now, the treatment is very effective usually. Cabergoline, which is Dostanex, twice weekly, it's more effective than bromocriptine and better tolerated generally. The side effects, nausea, dizziness, I tell them, take this in the evening with food, either dinner or bedtime with food. After a couple doses, that usually goes away. Long-term side effects at high doses, pulmonary fibrosis. Bromocriptine, we still use it, but it's not as effective and has more of these side effects. The side effects are nausea and dizziness. Rarely does a prolactinoma need surgery. Other causes of mildly elevated prolactin, dopamine antagonists. Remember, dopamine lowers prolactin, so dopamine antagonists raise prolactin, such as metoclopramide, many antipsychotics, Haldol, Risperdal, pituitary stalk compression from a non-pituitary tumor, or from a pituitary tumor or a non-pituitary tumor. Nipple stimulation can raise a prolactin. Caffeine can raise a prolactin, including methylxanthines, such as in chocolates. Acromegaly, we'll switch gears, talk about acromegaly. I have two cases recently, and you find this surprisingly more than you think. But acromegaly is a growth hormone excess, the signs and symptoms, classic, doughy and large hands, you almost know it when you shake their hands, increasing hand and foot size, large tongue, frontal bossing, prominent chin, increased cardiovascular mortality. Lab is a high IGF-1 level. We actually measure as a baseline test, we measure IGF-1, not growth hormone. There is a growth hormone suppression test you do if the IGF-1 is high. You do a glucose tolerance test and you check their growth hormone level hourly for a few hours. So the lab is a high IGF-1 level, and if you check GH, it will be high probably, although don't need to check GH, and might have deficits other pituitary hormones. Okay, we'll try to advance this there. Generally, acromegaly, when you find this, it's generally a very large pituitary tumor. Check the IGF-1 level, as I mentioned. Treatment is surgery. You want to have surgery for this. Possibly octreotide or pegvisomant to palliate. Possibly radiation therapy, depending on if they can get the whole thing after surgery. This is a before picture. I apologize for the blurriness. And this is her after. Now, acromegalic phenotype doesn't change, so she will not improve just by treating her acromegaly. Her facial features will remain prominent. TSH secreting tumor. This is very rare. The only reason I put this in here is because we're misled a lot to think that a patient has a TSH secreting tumor. A lot of patients have an elevated TSH, or in this patient, I'm sorry, they'll have an elevated TSH and usually an elevated free T4, but they're hyperthyroid. They often have hyperthyroid symptoms. So we get a lot of patients who have an elevated, the patient who has an elevated TSH, well, I'll read this here. In a patient with chronic poorly treated hypothyroidism, there might be significant pituitary thyrotroph hyperplasia. So you might notice a big pituitary, a tumor that looks like a tumor on the pituitary. But in this case, the TSH is going to be high, and the T4 will be low. So if you get a T4 that's low, TSH is high, and they have a tumor in the pituitary, that's not a TSH secreting tumor. It might be pituitary thyrotroph hyperplasia. Treat the hypothyroidism, and the tumor should shrink down to nothing. So that's something I've had a couple times in my practice, and you don't want to misinterpret that. Cushing's disease, ACTH secretion, ACTH dependent Cushing's, in other words, with pituitary. Cushing's disease is caused by ACTH secretion, whereas Cushing's syndrome is anything that elevates the cortisol level and causes the symptomatology. These people have obesity, stria, ecchymoses, hyperglycemia, atherosclerosis, thin skin, fatigue, fat pads, hyperpigmentation, infections, and it's their supraclavicular fat pad. A lot of patients have dorsal humps, but the supraclavicular you're looking for. Diagnosis can be is 24-hour urine-free cortisol, dexamethasone suppression test, which I'll talk about later, salivary cortisol between 11 p.m. and midnight, although you might have to, this can be subtle and can be somewhat cyclic, so you might have to repeat these tests multiple times if you have a high index of suspicion. Treatment is surgery and then might need radiation. This is a before picture, and this is an after picture. And this, she can revert back to her before picture with treatment. Dexamethasone suppression testing. We should all have this in our bag of tricks. This is not a hard test to do. It's 1 milligram, this is a low dose test, 1 milligram of dexamethasone at 11 p.m. Then get a fasting cortisol the next morning at 8 a.m. Normal result is suppression to less than 2 or 3. We like to see it less than 2. I also tend personally to order an ACTH level with this because I always am sorry I didn't. I think we should probably order a dexamethasone level because if you're at an academic institution or you transfer the patient to an academic institution, they'll say, well, did she absorb the dexamethasone? Is that why her cortisol is not low? Because she didn't absorb it. So if you get a dexamethasone level, which takes 2 or 3 weeks to come back, if it's in the appropriate range, then that tells you she absorbed it and it was an efficient test. If abnormal, indicates a possibility of cortisol excess and further testing is needed. It doesn't guarantee they have Cushing's. Obtaining a baseline ACTH level, as I mentioned, obtaining a baseline ACTH level without suppression at some point is very helpful in patients who end up having abnormal low-dose suppression tests. This can help us differentiate ACTH-dependent from ACTH-independent Cushing's. So if you know if their ACTH level is high, you'll think, oh, this is probably from the pituitary. If their ACTH level is low, as another slide will say, then you can stop and say it's adrenal. Or non-pituitary ectopic ACTH. Not ectopic ACTH, because that would be a very high ACTH level, but it would be adrenal. So here's a high-dose overnight dexamethasone suppression testing. Obtain a baseline cortisol level and an ACTH level. Give 8 milligrams of dexamethasone at 11 p.m. Fasting cortisol level the next a.m. at 8 a.m. Normal is 50% reduction in cortisol. Interpretation, adrenal Cushing's is a failure to suppress cortisol with a low dose. So when you give them the 1 milligram dexamethasone, they don't suppress. It could be adrenal, but pituitary tends to suppress with that. But they have a low ACTH level at baseline. Usually don't need the high dose dexamethasone. I'm sorry, I said that wrong. Neither of them suppress with 1 milligram of dexamethasone. But with adrenal, their ACTH level is low, but you usually don't need to get an 8 milligram dexamethasone suppression test because their ACTH level is low, and that pretty much seals it with Cushing's with a low ACTH. Okay, so next slide. Pituitary Cushing's, they fail you to suppress also with a 1 milligram dexamethasone test, but they have adequate suppression with the 8 milligram dexamethasone suppression test. They usually have an elevated or normal or top normal ACTH level at baseline. And again, don't go by a baseline cortisol. I usually get a cortisol with an ACTH. Cortisol can be normal or high or even a little bit low, and they still could have Cushing's. So baseline cortisol level is not very accurate. Ectopic ACTH, they don't suppress with anything. And their ACTH level is very high, some super high ACTH levels. They often have a metabolic alkalosis and hypokalemia. So if you ever see somebody with a metabolic alkalosis, hypokalemia, think they could have ectopic ACTH syndrome from a lung cancer. Empty cella syndrome, fairly common. We see it all the time on incidental MRIs. Often asymptomatic, but can have any degree of partial to full hypopituitarism. Might be due to invagination of the CSF into the cella, compressing the cella. Over time, the cella might get so compressed that it just disappears or become such a thin layer that you can't see it. Doesn't mean it's not working fully or partially. Also, you can have pituitary infarction or other things can do this. You can have cellar extension of non-pituitary tumors, meningiomas. They could cause elevated prolactin, might cause diabetes insipidus by stalk compression, might cause visual field defects, might cause any degree of insufficiency of the pituitary. Diabetes insipidus, this is something that is very easy sometimes to diagnose and very difficult to diagnose on other times, because we have a case right now of a young lady who's urinating a lot. Now the question is she urinating a lot because she's drinking a lot, or does she have diabetes insipidus and she's drinking because she is trying to replete fluid loss? And I haven't seen her as a patient, I've just seen her charts, but this is a million-dollar question. A loss of vasopressin secretion, the central DI, or they can be complete or partial diabetes insipidus in the central version. If it's complete diabetes insipidus, this is another endocrine emergency. If they don't drink enough, if they don't have access to fluids, they can die in hours from dehydration and hypernatremia. So they cannot concentrate their urine. They have hypernatremia, dehydration, elevated serum osmolality. And again, some patients with partial DI and intact thirst mechanisms, they can drink enough to maintain their normal serum sodium levels. So if given that free access to water, they'll drink when they're thirsty. They may not have high sodium. Don't be misled. They still can have partial diabetes insipidus. Urine osmolality, less than 290 with elevated serum osmolality. You can see if their urine osmolality is low, their urine is dilute, and they have an elevated serum osmolality, they're not able to concentrate their urine. Generally have frequent urination. Confirmation test if needed, water deprivation test very cautiously. You put them in the hospital and don't give them water. And you can look this up on UpToDate if you wanted, or any site, but it basically involves not giving them water, weighing them, checking their lights every couple of hours or hour, and stopping the test if they lose too much weight or they develop hypernatremia. And then giving them DDAVP to see if they respond to it. Diabetes insipidus treatment, replete fluids to correct the serum sodium in the hospital. Sometimes that's all you need to do, at least initially. DDAVP, which is desmopressin, can be given IV, sub-Q, nasal spray, or oral. We have all these options. Initiate when the serum sodium level is rising or in the 140 range or higher, and this is important. Treatment with DDAVP might be needed based on hypernatremia and or to improve the urinary frequency. In other words, some patients just don't want to urinate so often if they have diabetes insipidus. Their sodium might be fine. So you might have to raise their DDAVP and concomitantly lower their fluid intake since they're retaining more fluid if you raise their DDAVP. So just watch. If you adjust their DDAVP, you might have to adjust their fluid intake. And that's this next slide. Especially in a head trauma patient, with cerebral edema, you have to be careful. If you give them DDAVP, they retain fluid. You don't want cerebral edema patients to retain fluid. So you have to be careful not to fluid overload them at the same time as you're making them retain fluid. And they often don't have a thirst mechanism when they finally wake up, so that you have to be very, very consistent about how much fluid they take in. The maintenance dose of DDAVP then will likely depend on sodium level and the convenience of frequency of urination and the amount of fluid a patient can take in a day. Now, other pituitary issues, head irradiation, can cause hypopituitarism years later. I had this one patient, I tell this story all the time, but I had this one patient years ago in the hospital who was hospitalized in the intensive care unit for about 3 weeks, and this was probably 18 years ago. And he with failure to thrive, he was on the ventilator for about 2 weeks, couldn't wean. A gastroenterologist actually ordered a testosterone level and it came back zero. So they consulted me, said, could he have low muscle mass causing him not to be able to be weaned? And I thought, oh, that's possible, but a level of zero? So I talked to his wife and lo and behold, he had radiation for lung cancer that metastasized to his lung. To his brain, he had radiation for that exactly 10 years earlier. So it turned out he had developed hypopituitarism 10 years later, and that was causing him to be, he had acute adrenal insufficiency. That day I started him on stress doses of steroids, and 3 days later he walked out of the hospital. It can be very rewarding to catch these cases. Sheehan syndrome, postpartum pituitary necrosis, usually due to infarction of a pituitary adenoma during a difficult delivery with hypotension. The tumor just implodes, basically. hemorrhage of a pituitary tumor. If it gets big enough, it gets enough blood flow, it can hemorrhage. Hypothalamic dysfunction, hard to test for. Infiltrative disease, sarcoid, TB, et cetera. And autoimmune hypophysitis. I had a case once of autoimmune hypophysitis that was very interesting. This patient had a huge pituitary tumor. It was like 2 centimeters. And we were really getting nervous about this. We were sending them to consider surgery. Got an MRI. A month later, it was gone. So she had inflammation of her pituitary, and the inflammation resolved. The tumor got better. She had no pituitary insufficiency. Hypopituitarism, flu-like symptoms, urgent diagnosis, another endocrine emergency, glucocorticoid replacement, hydrocortisone 10 to 20 milligrams in the morning and 5 to 10 milligrams in the evening with food, prednisone 5 to 7.5 milligrams daily or the equivalent. I'm a fan of hydrocortisone, but it's not wrong to give prednisone. Some people don't metabolize prednisone in their liver effectively to the active cortisol, so every now and then a person fails prednisone. Consider testosterone or estrogen treatment, levothyroxine replacement. TSH level is not useful in determining the dose since pituitary can't make TSH adequately. So remember, when you're getting thyroid functions in somebody who has pituitary insufficiency and they're on thyroxine, don't check a TSH, or if you do and it's low, don't lower the dose of thyroxine. You have to have a knowledge of what the replacement dose of thyroxine should be. And our goal is in these patients to maintain the free T4 in the mid to upper normal range if we can, and knowing that most patients need a dose of thyroxine, a replacement dose of about 1.64 or 1.7 times their kilogram weight is their microgram dose of levothyroxine if they have no thyroid function. Might need DDAVP, growth hormone. Diagnosis, flu-like symptoms, nauseous, dizzy, achy, et cetera. I tell these patients, of course, get a medic alert bracelet, but if you only have one of these, if you're nauseous, it could be anything. If you're nauseous, dizzy, achy, that's more likely to be acute adrenal insufficiency. Low FSH in a postmenopausal woman not on estrogen. That's a good way if you have a question about whether a patient's hypopit, a menopausal woman, get a FSH. If it's not high, you have to seriously consider pituitary insufficiency. Low total and free testosterone level and luteinizing hormone. Again, they will have often very low testosterones and very low luteinizing hormones. Total testosterone is just my 2 cents. The guidelines say total testosterones are reasonable to check. Because the buck stops with me, I always check free testosterones because I see a lot of discordance between total and free testosterones because of abnormalities of sex hormone binding globulins. So I like to look at free testosterones, not necessarily as a screening test, but if the testosterone level comes back low. They could have a low sodium, possibly low morning cortisol level, but it's not a sensitive test. Or an abnormal ACTH stimulation test, except the caveat is if they just got pituitary insufficiency yesterday, their adrenals still function. So their ACTH stim test will still be normal because ACTH, cortrosin, which you give for the ACTH stimulation test, is ACTH. So it's stimulating the adrenal glands, which are still responsive to ACTH. Low TSH and low free T4, it may take 2 months or so or more for the adrenals not to become responsive to ACTH. A low TSH and low free T4, or a low free T4 and appropriately normal TSH. So this is what I was saying earlier mistakenly. I get a lot of consults for a patient with a slightly low free T4 and a normal TSH. Could it be pituitary insufficiency? Could be. Or they have a low TSH, they have a TSH of 0.3 and they have a free T4 that's 0.9. Could that be pituitary insufficiency? It could be, but it's almost always mild hyperthyroidism or normal, close to normal. Case one is a 35-year-old recent postpartum female treated with Clomid for fertility. Hypotensive during delivery, orthostatic, hyponatremic, hyperkalemic, past history of oligomenorrhea and galactorrhea. I think I sort of talked about this case already, with Sheehan syndrome. She likely had a pituitary adenoma, possibly a prolactinoma, that was causing her to be infertile, and so she needed fertility treatments. And of course, a fertility doctor would have checked a prolactin, so this is a make-believe case. But this tumor grew during pregnancy. Prolactinomas will grow during pregnancy. If they're small, they don't grow a lot. But if they're big, they can grow enough to cause pituitary insufficiency or can cause be infarcted. So when she became hypotensive during her tough delivery, she infarcted her pituitary tumor and got Sheehan syndrome. Case two is a 60-year-old centrally obese patient, 80-pound weight increase in 1 year. Type 2 diabetes for 3 years, tan skin, leg weakness, violaceous new stretch marks. What does this person have? Probable type 2 diabetes alone, but Cushing's is what I'm getting at. Right. The point I'm making is that almost all our type 2 patients look like they have Cushing's, but we can't get complacent. We have to do a lot of testing for Cushing's because of this. They just all look like they have Cushing's. So type 2 diabetes versus Cushing's. So you're right, a person in this make-believe scenario has Cushing's. Obtain an overnight 1 milligram dexamethasone suppression test and or a 24-hour urine-free cortisol and or a midnight salivary cortisol. You might need to pursue this several times. The best test would be, if there was a question about this, I would say 1 milligram dexamethasone suppression test or a 24-hour urine-free cortisol. They could both be equally effective. Case three is a 34-year-old head trauma victim, polyuria, while IV fluids are infusing on dexamethasone. Serum sodium's 168. They're confused. This is an important case because I said the sodium level was high. And in a second, I'll show you what if the sodium level was normal. And that's what we're mistreating in the hospital all the time. But this patient desperately needs DDAVP. They're hypernatremic. They have DI. Very few things cause sodium levels to go high. DI, diabetes insipidus, is one of them. So this person needs DDAVP desperately since has DI, and sodium level is high. IV fluids can cause polyuria, as can postoperative diuresis, but you wouldn't get the high sodium. If this was just post-op diuresis, you wouldn't get the high sodium. Dexamethasone, which the person's on for cerebral edema, can exacerbate DI, so the DI might get less bad as you wean off the dexamethasone. Now, what if this patient's sodium level was 135 and they're peeing like a racehorse? Would you give them DDAVP? No, because you're going to retain more fluid, dilute them more, the sodium's going to drop to the 120s, 110s. You're going to kill them. And this is what you don't just treat on the polyuria. You treat on the polyuria and the sodium level. So what you then you wouldn't give DDAVP. Adjust fluids to urine output, hold off on DDAVP until the sodium level is perhaps in the low 140s, then you can start DDAVP, adjust the fluids and the DDAVP to prevent fluid overload and to maintain serum sodium level in the normal range. This person might not even have diabetes insipidus.